trains, the Ghost Ease, and more. This is an all-ages family-friendly event, which will also have a raffle, palm readings, a photo booth, and more. Again, that's the Liberty Ball, Saturday, June 17th, from 6 p.m. to midnight at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2017 Juneteenth Celebration on Saturday, June 17th in Foster Hall at Clark College, Vancouver, Washington. Juneteenth, aka Freedom Day or Emancipation Day, is a holiday commemorating the abolition of slavery in the state of Texas some 2 years after slavery was abolished. The Juneteenth Celebration will feature African dance, speakers, music, food, a pie contest, and more. Again, that's the 2017 Juneteenth Celebration on Saturday, June 17th in Foster Hall at Clark College, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO and to Positively Revolting. I'm not Ani or Lynn. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, subbing for your regular hosts. I hope that works for you. They had a little vacation, and I got an opportunity to do programming, which I'm so happy to do. Today on our program, we have a guest. His name is Ryan Lentz. He is the senior writer of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its blog Hate Watch. Before joining the Southern Poverty Law Center in 2010, Lentz was a regional reporter for the Associated Press and an Iraq War correspondent and wire service from 05 to 08. He is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Well, he certainly writes well. I can tell that from reading the stuff that he did, so we can see it in his background. Welcome to KBOO, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you. This is a call-in show, and normally I would open the lines now, but I want to get a chance to talk to Ryan Lentz, and so I'm not going to open those lines. I am going to give you, the audience, the number so you can be ready when the time comes. It's 503-231-8187. And Ryan is only able to be with us for 20 minutes. I'm so grateful that you guys could cut loose some time to be on our radio station. I imagine that you're overwhelmingly busy.
You cannot even imagine.
Yeah, I really think I can't. I wondered, are they trying to figure out how to hire more staff or what to do in the midst of all of what you're covering? For those who don't know, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been the preeminent organization tracking and following and talking about hate crimes in the United States. And so I'm asking you, Ryan, you're probably very aware. In fact, I know you are, because we pulled off, I believe, your Hate Watch blog, a list of additional hate crimes that had happened in Oregon starting in January, February, and March. And we certainly know about the murders on the Max. And there have actually been even more recent ones than that. Of course, there was a man attacked by someone who pushed him off the road. He was Hispanic. He told him to go back to Mexico and put a gun to his head. There was a young boy walking out of his middle school to his bus stop, and he was harassed all the way to the bus stop by two men yelling slurs at him. And there have been more. So I'm so glad that you cover us so well. What I'd like you to do today is put us in the national context, if you could, because you've got a much broader view, and we hear about many of the things going on, but put the kind of activities that are happening in Oregon in that national context for us, if you could.
Sure. Well, a quick clarifying point. You mentioned that we were tracking hate crimes. So we're actually tracking hate and bias incidents. The hate crime is a legal designation. So just to clarify that single point.
Okay.
And this is a point I made a couple of times regarding Oregon after the Max killings. Oregon is just part of a national story right now. What's happening across the country is nothing short of the legitimization of extremist ideologies. We have seen since the election almost 2,000 incidents of hateful intimidation and harassment across the country. These are horrific incidents. People being harassed because they're Muslim or Hispanic, people waking up to find swastikas graffitied on their cars. And it really speaks to a climate from coast to coast wherein the political atmosphere has legitimized or normalized ideologies that have long existed in the shadows of our culture.
And it's interesting because they're not, it's not that it takes so much brains to do what they're doing, but they are, you know, being a little clever at it, calling them free speech rallies, for example.
Well, that's somewhat separate from the incidents. We've seen a number, you know, since the election, extremists have taken to the public sphere to recruit, to radicalize, and to indoctrinate young people mostly into their cause. There's been tremendous press or pushback from various anti-fascist organizations and groups that has led to some very contentious street battles in Berkeley and elsewhere.
Seattle, I think, last weekend.
Seattle too, yes. And the ideologues, the extremist leaders of these groups are citing their First Amendment privileges as defense against the violence that they seem to be on the receiving end of. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting flip, you know, because, you know, for 8 years during the course of the Obama administration, we saw almost immediately, beginning in 2009, extremist groups across the spectrum of ideologies just go wild.
Mm-hmm.
In 2009, we counted, I believe, upwards of 1,260 hate groups active in the country. That number has changed. Of course, it fluctuates through the years. Groups break up, infighting occurs, and people disband. But it remains high. Last year, there were 917 hate groups in the country. We don't know what the election and the very bruising rhetoric of the campaign trail will mean for the organized hate movement in the United States. But we're in the process of tallying those numbers now.
Uh-huh. Well, I like that you made the distinction for me to make sure that I made the distinction between these groups and their rallies and activities and all the individual hate attacks that happen and whether the individuals who are doing those attacks are part of these groups or not. We may not ever know. Many of these things don't get found. I'm not sure they ever found. This was just a week ago, the two men that were harassing the boy as he left his school.
Right.
I know that the man who killed people with his knife had taken violent rhetoric and action against an African-American woman just earlier in the week, and that they did not go to find him or to arrest him or to stop him. And so because those come out of the blue, they're very hard to cope with. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, how do we prevent this? Like when I heard about the boy from his school, and I know, of course, that children have faced racist words and comments from school or other kinds of bias language always since I've been alive. But this upsurge seems very real, and something's emboldening these people to do acts that they might not otherwise do, especially attacking children and young people. I think that expresses their cowardice. But how do you see that we as a public, was one of the questions I wanted to ask, how do you see we should handle the upsurge in those kinds of things? You know, we kind of know how to do an anti-protest protest.
Sure, but, I guess the reality is we just have to call them out, you know. There's not a single incident that should be forgotten or dismissed. A lot of people worry that by drawing attention to these incidents that it will inspire copycat activity.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with that. I think that the best antiseptic for these types of ideologies is transparency, is exposure, to let people know this exists, you know. I think one of the things I would encourage is to recognize that it's not always best to meet fire with fire. In other words, witnessing or hearing about these types of incidents inspires in people this, you know, anger and frustration. You know,
yes.
They stand aghast that this can actually happen in America, you know, 60 plus years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, you know, and immediately following the election of our nation's first African-American president. But, call these things out. Make sure people know they exist. Draw attention to them and address it on your in your communities, on a community level, to make sure that whatever cultural forces are at work that compel people into feeling that they need to behave this way or that it's okay to behave this way is not okay.
Yes. I know that the parents of the school, and I don't know the official school response, but I think it was fairly strong, but parents at the school showed up in large numbers to show their support for the boy and to say, no, you can't do that to our students. They may be coming up with a plan to be able to watch kids to make sure that they do get to their bus, you know, that they are. It's middle school, yeah. So kids have a lot more autonomy in middle school, but if they're not going to be safe on the street, then we need to have other plans for our children in the city. I wanted to talk a little bit about how important was it that Trump has installed what many people feel are, at the very least, extreme right. Many people feel are straight-out fascists in what they advocate. Stephen Bannon, Michael Flynn, Stephen Miller, Sebastian Gorka. Can you talk about how important it is that he has filled his top leadership with people that are overtly extremist?
Well, following a presidential campaign that blew dog whistles to the radical right, you know, Donald Trump handpicked many of the leading intellectuals of the radical right, or whose ideas are sprung from the radical right, to fill positions in his cabinet and his administration. This happened within the first 100 days. The message mm-hmm. that sends to the radical right, to organized hate groups in this country, and to people who are increasingly being exposed and radicalized to extremist thought online, is that it's okay. You know, this is now the government. You know, for decades we've been watching the movement of these ideologies from the margins of our culture into the mainstream of our country, and with those people filling these positions in the administration, it sends a message to die hard right, radical extremists in this country, that they have that they are in the mainstream. They are inside the wire. They are in positions of power now and can enforce their policies. It sent a message across the radical right that these ideas were on the rise and they were here to stay.
And I think that we've seen that the right has definitely heard the message. I wanted to ask you what you thought about, we had the militia-type people that took over the Malheur Refuge in eastern Oregon. It's a federally protected property, and there were buildings on it. And they were there for 2 months, and they harassed and intimidated local members, following them home, calling them with hate calls, putting stuff in their mailboxes. They were armed. They ran through the streets armed in their trucks all the time for like 2 months, and they also did much damage to the building, and yet they came away with almost nothing in terms of a hand slap, is what I think of it as. And I know, frankly, that if any one of the protesters I know took spray paint to the side of the federal building downtown, they would be in jail.
Right.
And there's no question about that. So what do you think happened in that particular case? And if you don't know what happened, do you think that them getting off so lightly sent a signal, a green light?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It sent a message, you know, to that particular component of the right, you know, the anti-government extremists, that there may be no consequence for criminal activity, you know, and that stems, what happened in Oregon at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge stems directly or ties directly to the standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014. I was there at that standoff on the day that things boiled over, and I continue to be amazed that the federal government and federal prosecutors did nothing to bring those extremists to justice.
So we have an interesting question here, you know, is there infiltration of our law enforcement throughout the nation from these kinds of organizations? I certainly know that John Birch used to infiltrate intelligence, or they were connected with intelligence organizations in different police jurisdictions.
Well, there are organizations like the Oath Keepers, which recruit from former police and military personnel to, you know, into a cause that feels that the federal government is tyrannical. I can't really speak to how widespread, these are all former police officers and military personnel, and I can't speak to how deeply these ideologies stem into the current force or reach into the current force. I can say that we do know that a lot of some law enforcement and certainly some military members are sympathetic to the ideas and the doctrines of groups like the Oath Keepers.
Yes, we have a policeman that put up he posted in a public area praise of different Nazi personnel. And
well, there's a distinction between Nazis and anti-government extremists.
Well, okay,
there's
go ahead, tell us.
Yeah, there's another, hate groups are groups that seek to vilify people for immutable characteristics, you know, the color of their skin, their ethnicity, their sexual orientation. Anti-government extremists are people who are consumed by conspiracy theories that the federal government is seeking to enslave or keep U.S. citizens in financial slavery or control population or is working in cahoots with an international cabal of blue helmeted soldiers who will one day come in and declare martial law and rob the country of its sovereignty. Those are the types of people who were active in Nevada and who were active in Oregon around the Malheur incident.
Mm-hmm.
There's bleed over between the two branches of this radical right tree,
but they're not the same, and their agenda is not exactly the same. I am concerned though that the response to those, you know, we know that they, you know, put some quote eco terrorists in jail for setting on fire pickups. And they gave him a terrorism enhancement on that, which makes the sentencing much harsher. And yet these people at Harney County, they didn't get anything close to that. And so it appears that there's a way that the federal prosecution is handling different groups differently.
That's absolutely true. You know, the federal government has had a tremendously difficult time understanding or coming to a solution as to how to address the very concept of Americans who are American citizens who are indoctrinated who have bought into these ideologies, you know, and our contention is that, you know, someone coming into and taking over a federal building and promising violence if their needs are not met, that, you know, by definition that's domestic terrorism.
Yes,
but on a prosecution level, there's a different approach to those people from someone inspired by extreme Islamic beliefs.
Yes, or as when the ecology movement was under their gun, they actually wrote special laws so that you cannot photograph, animals being abused and animal, you know. So they go pretty hard on the things they want to go pretty hard on, and they don't on the things they don't.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I had heard that there's an organization called ACT that is about to schedule more anti-Sharia demonstrations. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's an organization called ACT for America. It was started by a woman named Brigitte Gabriel. She's a Lebanese Christian woman and American who really works with legislators on state, local, and national levels to focus on a really harsh anti-Islamic agenda. This group feels that Muslims in America are seeking to undermine constitutional law by asserting that Islamic law applies here. It's a complete fiction.
Yeah, I haven't ever heard of it at all.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So a week ago or a week and a half ago, there were protests in 28 cities across the country, from Texas to California and elsewhere, that were to stand against the so-called implementation of Sharia law in the United States. It's a completely ridiculous notion that, that has been bandied about on this particular in this particular ecosystem of the radical right, but yet it's garnered a tremendous following. People who feel that, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, that Muslims in America pose a serious threat, not just to the nation's national security, but to, you know, to the very identity of what America is.
And it's interesting that they don't even know how to identify who actually is Muslim versus who's Sikh or who's something else, but they take it all to be the other that they want to go against.
Right.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, you said you don't always fight fire with fire. You're talking about the individual incidents, but, you know, here in Portland at that at the rally that we had about a week ago, the right wing had come in. There were significant numbers of them, I would say 500 or more. And then there were anti-rallies with three kind of broader groupings, you could say, each one having somewhere between 800 and 1,500 people that surrounded where they were and managed to stay through the end until they were escorted out. And I think they were given a lot of coverage by the press who got to hear their message. But if you were down in that area, you certainly wouldn't hear their message because they were drowned out by all of the demonstrators. What do you think about doing that? They're saying they're going to hold a rally and anti-demonstrations against that rally.
Well, those people have First Amendment rights just as everyone else does. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue is that the counter-protests are increasingly turning violent, and that's something that we condemn as an organization and we should condemn as a country.
I know in Seattle that there were some of the ACT demonstrators, actually, according to regular news, were marching alongside the, I would say, more leftist demonstrators and started pushing them and catcalling and started, and that part of their goal was to start physical incidents between them and what they consider the Antifa, the anti-fascist.
I mean, it is a complex environment right now, mm-hmm. with all sorts of different groups trying by any means necessary ultimately to figure out how to address this rise of extremism.
Yeah,
it's created a lot of controversy and a lot of damage, a lot of injuries across the country. It's an interesting. I sometimes compare it to the upside down. You know, these are people who are claiming now that their First Amendment rights are being violated, but people who for 8 years of the Obama administration ran wild with the expression of these ideas. So
yes.
It's simply that, you know, that there's a component of this country, you know, a sizable one, that doesn't agree with these ideologies, that has led the intellectual leaders of these movements to turn on this idea of, well, you can't silence us and you shouldn't be able to silence us.
Yes. Well, Ryan, I think we've used up all your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been
fun. It's been really great. I've been speaking with Ryan Lenz. He's with the Southern Poverty Law Center. You can catch his blog. It's called, what's your blog called?
Hate Watch,
that's right. Hate Watch. And so you can look and get up-to-date information and articles on that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. Bye-bye. And now, guys out there, audience out there, you've gotten to hear Ryan talk about, you know, we just touch on the national issues. Please give us a call and tell us what you're thinking about this. That number is 503-231-8187. You know, we'd like to hear from you about this issue. Obviously, we've been focusing on it a lot. So have others here in Portland. I know that I just want to throw a shout out to Street Roots, a really good newspaper that does a lot of good coverage. Some of it they take from their national network and some of it's from local events here, but they've been covering this issue very well. One of the things they've been talking about is safety concerns that people have, that Muslim particularly have and transit operators have, about what's been happening on our buses and on our MAX line. I think that that's an important thing to talk about. And if you have experience with any kind of hate-related problem going on that, please do give us a call and let us know. It's 503-231-8187. 1-800-273-8787. I also want to know, what do you think you need to do when it comes to this kind of crimes? Do you just need to stay aware of them, maybe post them to friends on Facebook? Do you feel that you need to go down and be a demonstrator when there's the appropriate opportunity for that? I'd like to hear how you're responding to the kind of extreme right hate that's been raising. And, you know, when we talk about these hate crimes, we didn't mention it very much, but Southern Poverty Law Center absolutely covers hate crimes against transgender, against people because they're gay or lesbian, all of those hate crimes as well. And they, as we well know, I mean, the Pulse nightclub was just a year ago. Those are also targets of this extreme right wing. The society they imagine us having seems so different than the one that we actually come out of, the one that's actually growing and changing all the time. Just as so many of us, they of course are threatened, as so many of us come to realize that transgender and many various ways that that expresses itself is a normal part of the human spectrum, and we can embrace and love them just like everybody else. Of course, you know, once something begins to get a little bit more out there, those with the more conservative view are going to want to come back at us. So I haven't had any of you call. I think we'll take a little break with some music if our engineer has any. And I'll let him take that moment, and I'll let you guys think about this. Hate crimes, hate activities going on in the world. Actually, you know what I'll do before I do that is I'll let you know what's coming up on KBOO, because we do have a great day lined up for you here, as we usually do. So coming up this morning at 9 will be Veterans Voice. We'll hear from the Army and Air Force vet Lisa Ling, who worked in the United States drone program and is featured in the new documentary National Bird, now on Netflix. That sounds really important to me. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. I have to say, I'm always so happy we have Flashpoints on. They cover some of the same issues, but other issues from the left and that we don't hear about very often. So I'm so appreciative of that. At 11, it's going to be the Radio Zine. It presents Between Us, an interview with local artist Sade, I'm thinking is the way we say her name, Sade Beasley, whose work honors Black women's strength and femininity. And I want to thank all of you KBOO members for your generous support. You know, you've come through for us for 49 years, going on to 50 coming up, supporting the community radio station that is yours. And I want to thank you very much for doing that, each and every one of you. Okay, we'll go to a little music now. And now we're back, and I do believe we have Steve on the line.
Yeah, hello.
Good morning, Steve.
I was, I was triggered to call you because you said that there was nobody on the line after your...
Oh, yes. I'm glad that got your mind going. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I think what got my mind going is listening to you start out this morning, just, you know, talking about the hate that's been generating recently and then having that individual come on. And I just wanted to I was just sitting there thinking as I'm listening to it. Earlier this morning on Democracy Now!, Dave Archambault from the Oglala Sioux Tribe got on and interviewed with Amy regarding the victory that the courts have handed down with the Standing Rock pipeline. And so as I'm listening to that, and then your program came on about hate, and I agree with you, man. I am completely against all of the, I mean, it's my country. I'm 56 years old. I'm a service member, honorable discharge, disabled veteran, 1980 to 1986, and we're exactly where we were in 1979. Again.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying. It seems like we've gone quite a bit backwards, doesn't it?
Yeah, and on the hate issue, I think the thing that really is troubling with me about it, it's like promoting the idea of report suspicious activity. And what it is it's going, let's go back to the original history of the United States of America. We were founded on hate. Why do I say that? Because Caucasian people came to, and I'm a white person.
Right.
So I've got a dog in the fight, but I'm a dog that's fighting the other dogs, the other white dogs that come over here to the land and continue to not talk about healthily the fact that white people came over to this land, stole it, murdered the people that were here, and then colonized it. And until white people are comfortable enough to talk about, we are the perpetrators of hate, and through our guise of Christianity that we've spewed on the people here, our version, until we as white people come to terms that we are the cause of the hate in this land, we're always going to segregate other groups, and we're going to let white people shoot and commit crimes and not call them terrorists.
Well, Steve, I think that what you're saying is really pretty accurate. It's right on for what actually goes on in this country. And it's pretty discouraging, but there are victories. And I think that's what you were starting to say about the Standing Rock one. You know, it's great when we find out these victories, but these are victories of people who are fighting to maintain, sovereignty over, though they wouldn't say sovereignty over the land, but maintain the areas that they traditionally were living in. And it's still an ongoing fight. You know, I was thinking about, someone was talking about, Turkey committed genocide against the Armenians, which they did do. And then I thought, but we're in an ongoing genocide. We just keep going. We keep trying to get into Native American lands to dump poisons in, or to, to take minerals out of. And I don't think it's quite over yet. And I appreciate you bringing that up, Steve. And thanks for calling. I think we do have another caller on the line now. John, thanks for calling in, and I want to let people know that number before you speak, John. It's 503-231-8187. Good morning, John.
Well, I'm taking a different kind of view on it.
Okay.
This is all started with Reagan. I know it shouldn't be so prejudicial and, capsulize a concept, but as you know, Ronnie, when he got in there, it just floorboarded. And then when we got a Democrat in there, it was Clinton, and he was just the best Republican we ever had,
Yeah, I agree.
He wasn't, whatever. But anyway, I'm going to cut to the chase. When you have ground rules earlier this 21st century that were set down, I'm not going to go into really categorically, but first, my favorite ones, what the Supreme Court did earlier, is that it made lying free speech. And this came from a couple of journalists down in Florida that were covering pesticides. They went against their management, and they were fired, so they sued them because they said they were telling the truth. Well, Scalia and company, they said, well, it's all right to lie. And, of course, they 5-4, like always.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you got the trifecta, free speech. Money is free speech.
Right.
And corporations are people. So you got the trifecta there. Now, that set the whole balance that what do you want to call these hate groups or extreme Republican congressmen or senators, getting money underneath the table from who knows what, and then lying. right there to your face. And then we have a president who's a, you know, a sociopathic, narcissistic, you know, psychopath who just doesn't know what reality from, you know, from anything, and all he can do is lie, because that's how he got to be so powerful. Besides, well, money and lying. I mean, that's like what? Let's say used car dealerships. The pulpit, right? Or just go into politicians. Like lying and money. I mean, that's the worst concoction you could ever come up with.
Well, I think what I heard you say, John, that I think is the most interesting is that there have been changes in our government over the last many decades that have enabled this to come to the rise right now, that are far, you know, and those are in the background. We don't necessarily call the perpetrators of those acts fascists, but they're setting us up for a different society than we thought we had.
Well, table's already been set. No, and now you're just seeing the progress.
Yeah, yeah.
You're seeing the whole organism being attacked by a cancer. So now, you know, you have the whole three chambers of, well, four, you know, executive, legislative, and judicial, all considered,
dominated.
You know, in my mind, you know, it's 1857.
Well, I really appreciate what you have to say. We've got a couple others on the line. Thank you, John.
Just a concept, that's all.
No, and it's good. Thank you. Let's go to the next caller. Dennis, thanks for calling in.
Hello?
Hi, you're on.
Okay, I'm Dennis. Okay, I'd like to bring this a little bit, the same ideas, but to bring it a little bit closer to home. I'm a Reed College graduate. And last weekend, we had a reunion, and there was one of the guys who was in this horrible thing that happened on the Max line, was a Reed College graduate, and I think he was Muslim. Was he? Was that not true? I'm sorry, I can't remember.
I don't remember that being said, that he was Muslim.
Oh, well, okay. I mean, it was a terrible thing, and he could have been at the reunion if he'd been living, and because he just graduated, and this is for alumni. And I just, my heart goes out to his family and everything.
It was very shocking, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was very shocking in almost a personal way, even if you didn't know him. One of the young gentlemen who was knifed also was a KABU volunteer. He was very active in many parts of the community, but he was a KABU volunteer. And, you know, just knowing that I've walked past him or helped fundraise in the same time he's been in the station, it brought it home even closer. And I found it shocking in a way that I'm not usually shocked.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's what I had to say. Maybe someone else can verify
whether or not he was Muslim.
Whether this was Muslim, but it... okay, thank you very much.
Well, and thank you for calling. And I think we have another caller on the line. I do want to... It's Dan. And Dan, I want to give out that number. It's 503-231-8187. Please call in and talk about the national hate crime movement, what's been happening. And let's hear from you, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Ms. Olson. I applaud your measured discussion of the issues, and I'm calling because I'm actually of two minds of things and don't really know what conclusion to draw about something, and interested in your view and other callers. I attended the protest against the so-called free speech rally on Sunday the 4th. And it seems clear that the mass detention of some 200 protesters several blocks from the event was unconstitutional. That seems clear. The cops...
holding people and taking their IDs, not allowing them to leave the area.
Yeah, a bunch of Antifa and others marched off. They were being pushed. They were pushed out quite violently from Chapman and... exited Lonsdale Square and chose to go off, and the cops came up and surrounded them and kept them there for an hour, photographing IDs held up against their faces for future identification of some sort.
Yeah.
That's on the one hand. On the other hand, folks on both sides of that divide, the white nationalists and those protesting them, many were equipped for battle with sort of ad hoc, armored up with sports equipment and all kinds of stuff.
And who? Where did you see that? Because I was down there and I didn't see on the Black Bloc side people dressed up like that.
It was less on the Black Bloc side. Mostly there were some helmets.
Yeah, and I saw a couple people. I saw it in the newspaper though, actually, and the person holding it was someone I'd seen there, and I hadn't seen that holding up what you call them shields. I know that during the Vietnam War, the Japanese protesters always went to rallies with a club, a shield, and a helmet. so they used to armor up over there to go for a rally, but I really didn't see much of that, and I spent a lot of my time on that block.
You're correct, it was less. On the alt-right side, there was all kinds of almost comical
gear they were putting
stuff. But it seems clear that there were elements of both sides that were spoiling for a fight. I think that's
I think there were no doubt some young people that would have wanted to fight them if they were attacked. I don't think they were in the mood to start something because I was there for hours and they weren't starting something. But I think they were definitely in the mood to take it on if it happened. Like up in Seattle where the Black Bloc did actually march right side by side with them and, you know, shove them. That's the kind of opportunity.
I don't know if I would agree in that regard, but let me ask my question.
Sure.
Does the violation of constitutional principles, on the one hand, may have helped prevent some serious violence, which nobody needs the heat under the kettle turned up in American politics today. Violence is just going to get more violence. There are those on the right who are welcoming it. In the spirit of opposition research, was watching Alex Jones on InfoWars. That kook.
Yeah, he's very.
Flat out was calling for civil war unabashedly, etc. So my question is, and I don't know the answer. Was it okay to detain these folks unconstitutionally if that kept a bunch of fairly high-energy people isolated blocks from the alt-right who were then able to leave with a lesser potential for violence?
Let's throw that out to the rest of the audience.
What do you think, Linda?
I don't think it was right, and I don't think there would have been that kind of clash if the police had not handled Black Bloc that way. The people in that block, for, you know, they had their medical supplies out, they had food out and water out for anybody who was overtaxed from the day. And I walked around and threw them and interacted with people in that block for most of the march, and I did not find that most people were, you know, eager to try to do something to get it on with the other side. I think that the police could have just kept them separated. You know, they put two, I don't know if you noticed, but they put two full lines of shoulder-to-shoulder armored-up police facing Chapman Square.
Oh, yeah.
And one line with a little shoulder room between them facing the right extremist. And they began announcing that they were going to, I heard the first announcement of this at 1 o'clock, I made a note of it, that they were going to push into Chapman Square and have people move up off the sidewalk, and if they didn't move, they would be considered doing something illegal and could be arrested. Well, that was at 1 o'clock, and there was, you know, it was just people still starting to gather.
Yeah.
I believe that the police planned to use this opportunity to discredit the people in the Antifa people, and to and I think they did it to take those photos. You know, there's photo recognition is big within policing now, especially within the national police, and there is a fusion center in this state, and that was federal territory as far as Homeland Security was considered. I think they'll use those, they'll put those in, they'll start a dossier on every one of those people that they gathered that from.
Yeah, they say that the records will be discarded. If what they're doing is they're examining video that they took of people allegedly, and I underscore allegedly,
involved in criminal
throwing all kinds of stuff at the cops, and they're comparing that video to the IDs they got. They say that no matches made, they will discard those records. If you choose to believe that, that they may well discard those records. No one knows.
I think it would be highly unlikely. You know, the Portland police, it was found in 1982, someone found their deceased police intelligence father had left boxes and boxes and boxes of all of the intelligence files of the police. He kept them individually. There was also a John Bircher policeman in Arizona who did the same thing, who kept records on all of the individuals that the intelligence, individuals and organizations that the intelligence portion of Portland police kept. The Tribune newspaper, if you want to go back and look at it, was who the family finally decided to give these boxes to. They saw all these files and and they gave them to the Tribune, and the Tribune opened them to anyone who had been involved in any of the activities that had been surveilled. So, you know, I went down and had a look, and the Tribune was great. But I don't think they're going to destroy those. They're already violating the law by giving any names to the Fusion Center to federal agents, because they never come back out. And we have a statute in Oregon that says unless you were suspected of committing a crime, if you were engaged in any First Amendment activities, you cannot collect and maintain that data. That's why the police are saying, oh, we won't keep it longer than 2 years. They're trying to give that 2 years. But the Fusion Center said directly to me that Oregon's law is Oregon's problem. Anyone that comes in through the Fusion Centers is under federal jurisdiction from that moment on. And all of the police agencies in Oregon, from tribal police to park rangers to the commissioner, probably because he's part of the police, can enter information into the Fusion Center and find out other information from other people. And so, you have them collecting all of this information, and a lot of that is facial recognition. They make a big point of using facial recognition in New York City and in Boston, et cetera. So I think they were doing it for that purpose.
Well, I enjoyed speaking with you. Food for thought, and I'll let other callers have a turn.
Yeah,
thank you,
Dan. And maybe someone will address your question. Would it have been, was it best for it to be handled the way it was, or how else can we do it?
It's really complicated,
isn't it? Yeah.
I'm an optimist, but I fear for this country. It's hitting the fan, and it's
scary.
Hard to predict exactly where all of this is headed.
Yes, it is. I agree with you. It doesn't look good, though, does it?
All right. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Solidarity with all the callers and listeners.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye.
Bye. And I believe we have another caller. Woman?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine.
You just wanted to hear another softer voice, huh?
Yeah. Tell me your name.
I'm with you. I like women, too.
Tell me your name.
Oh, Linda.
Linda. Yeah, I'm a person of cable.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard Steve, the call, and he said it's like we're right back to 1776 or something like that.
1857,
yeah,
I think he said.
And by the by, Taliesin's name is Taliesin. It's Gaelic. The brother who was killed by...
Oh, not Muslim, it's Gaelic, is what you're saying.
Yes, and...
Say his name again. I had trouble figuring it out from the way it's written.
Taliesin.
Taliesin.
Yes,
okay,
Frank Lloyd Wright made that name popular with his two properties that he built.
Oh, wow, I didn't
yes,
know.
Yes, and this is part of the problem from what I can see as to how we got to where we are today. As common as the name Taliesin is... Taliesin has been departed from us for days now, and I have not heard his name pronounced properly by anyone in the media.
Yeah.
So that should let you know right there how slow intellect creeps through webbage.
I hear, though, that his close friends called him Tilly.
They could call him Tilly.
Yeah, so I'm just saying that people picked an easier way to, an easier name.
But yeah, when you have a name like that, you can say it any kind of way amongst your friends.
Yeah, yeah.
But I called in response to the argument that they had on Sunday, the fascists against. I was down there. That was nasty. That was nasty the way the police acted. They mm-hmm. were agitating those folks.
Absolutely.
They were agitating because I was in a car, and they were agitating me in the car as we were riding by to film what was going on. They didn't want us down there filming.
I bet.
Them agitating. So anyway, I called to say our people need to fight our battles differently. Corporate America doesn't fight other corporations the way we fight them. They fight other corporations speaking money. We have to fight corporations using their language, meaning we have to withhold our funds so that they can hear us, because they speak money.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying withhold our funds, like stop paying our taxes?
No. I'm saying you have to use your wits about you.
Mm-hmm.
Things like sports events. My partner and I, every time we listen to the news and we hear about rallies and stuff, we say, well, the stands are still full. The stands are full. We have to stop packing those stands. When you go to sports arenas and big events like that, you're telling corporate America that you're happy. You see, your money is what they listen to, not our mouths, not our picket signs. Our money is what corporate America listens to. As long as we keep packing those stands, they don't see us in the street, and they don't hear us. We have to speak blood. When you go to sports events, don't buy concessions. You're stuck with the ticket because you probably bought that in advance, but do not buy concessions. Concessions is the blood and soul of sports, and sports is the blood and soul of America. When you put a tourniquet on that, you have their attention.
I hear what you're saying.
We will never get their attention. If I was in corporate America and I was on the 34th floor of Big Pink and I saw people now in the street picketing with signs and stuff, I wouldn't hear them. But you mess with my wallet while I'm up there on the 34th floor, I will hear you.
I hear what you're saying. I think it's a little complicated, though, because how do you let them know that you're withholding your money because of that?
Because we have to start watching where we spend. Start watching where we spend. How you think the bus boycott down in Mississippi and Alabama, how you think they were effective? They watched where they spend.
They cut off the flow of money completely.
Right. We just have to watch where we spend. We don't have to be extreme. We just say, all right, we want those Nikes. I'll buy those Nikes, but I'm going to put a Band-Aid over the Nike symbol.
I hear what you're saying.
Don't subscribe to their point of view, corporate America. Do enough to get their attention, and they will lobby for you.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Let's see what other callers have to say.
Okay, well, thank you for being here. Are you there every week?
Not every week, no. It's usually Lynn and... it's usually Lynn and Ani who are on, and I want to let other people know the number is 503-231-8187. Lynn and Ani should be back next week.
And to that other Reed caller, he said he was a graduate of Reed. No, Taliesin was not Muslim.
Thank you for making that clear. Yeah.
Okay. And I'll be in touch. I'm so glad you're on the air, and I'm glad that I support your station.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, then. I'll call back again next time you're on.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And any of the rest of you out there, you have a few more minutes. It's almost the last minute, but not quite. We'd like to have you call in and tell us what you think about what's been going on. I was wanting to look at the national scope in particular, but of course the local scope is important to look at. One of the questions I find for myself is when I hear... when I hear about a Hispanic man being driven off the road and the driver pulling out a gun and putting it to his head and saying, get out of this country, and then he hit him on the head with this. This happened just about the last 10 days here out in Washington County. No, it was not in Washington County. It was in Northeast Portland. So when I hear about things like that, I'm like, oh, I want to do something. What can I do? And I want to ask you what you do about it. Same thing with the Hosford child. I knew the school would respond well. I thought the parents would, and they did. But when something like that happens, what do we do to make sure that not just that child's safe, but all of our children are safe from a bias crime or a racist crime as they leave school? That's another issue that I really want to figure out. How do we address that issue? I know from knowing Muslim people that when things get tough and people are giving them dirty looks or they're just hearing a lot of bad stuff in the news, that it really makes a difference when you take an extra moment to say good morning or nod your head or give them, look them directly in the eye and smile. I'm talking about when you're on the bus, when you're in a grocery store, when you're walking through the mall or on the streets downtown. Just make sure that you acknowledge them. Some people... My sister and I argue about this, I'll tell you. Some people say, well, I don't say hello to everyone on the street. Well, I don't say hello to everyone on the street, but I generally nod my head or just acknowledge that I'm passing someone if I'm seeing them. And what I'm saying here is I know from Muslims that I know that they can tell when people are trying to make an extra effort to be nice to them because of the difficulties that are going on with attacks on Muslims and what we're hearing on the air. And so I think it's a really important issue for us to be talking about. I believe we have another caller on the line. Barry. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Linda. A book that I want to bring on that's ever so important is Solving 9/11.
I want to halt you, Barry. You and I have talked about this a lot of times, and I think that's a fine topic, but it's not the topic we're having this morning. And
yes,
so
it's the very basis of the topic that you have on.
Well, Barry, Barry, listen to me for a minute. Since I am the person who hosted this show and I picked out the topic, I say it's not part of the topic, and I don't want to start a discussion about 9/11. If you want to say the name of the book, if you want to say the name of the book one more time, I'll let you do that so the audience can hear it.
Okay, Solving 9/11 by Christopher Bolin. It's a very literal title. It is solving it, and it's not what we were told.
Okay, thank you for that, and I'll talk to you another time, Barry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. And I believe we have another caller on the line. Kyle, thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, I just wanted to throw a quick comment in there. I was listening to that lovely, nice woman who called the previous caller before the last one. And, you know, she's really right. You know, and I really practice that myself. My brother-in-law used to say, money doesn't talk, it screams.
Screams when I don't have it to pay a bill, that's for sure.
Well, that's true, but if you start depriving these people of their power and their money, which is money, then all of a sudden they start listening to you. Well, for instance, I put solar panels all over my roof. That's depriving PGE. I did that as a kickback to kick PGE in the butt for the last time that they were stuck with that Enron stuff. Remember Enron?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So and I remember Trojan. Oh, it couldn't be closed down no matter what. It was so dangerous. And then 2 days after the election, they announced their closure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, PGE is not on my favorite list of corporations.
So, you know, I think that collectively enough people started doing things like that, the PGE started changing their mind. That's why they're going to cleaner power, because people are starting to change their wallet mind. You got to change your wallet mind. We're going to start calling it wallet mind.
All right, that's okay.
You know, there's a water company that's local here, you know, and then there's one that's national. And the national one I got a hold of, and I thought, well, this would be a good one. And I got them in there, and I found out the money that I was paying was going down to Texas and Georgia. And I thought, those are the two worst states I want to send any money to any corporation. So I quickly cut them off, found a local water company. I won't mention their names because this is KBOO, it's non-commercial, but they're located right here in Oregon in Culver, and you know, and they're serving me water that's right up out of the ground, artesian well. You know, I mean, I have lead in my pipe, so I can't drink my water at home. So you know, but the thing is, I made the move, and that's what we all have to think about every single purchase we make. And we have to start purchasing things that are from companies that really are green, that really are espousing the things and doing the things that they espouse.
Well, I think taking money away from organizations does definitely have an effect. And from corporations, we know that boycotts have been very important. Israel wouldn't be making a law that they're not going to allow people in who have supported the boycotts. Tells you how effective a good boycott can be. And I also think just personally, I think it's less easy for anyone to tell, oh, they didn't buy this, they didn't buy that. But I think as an individual, I know that every year my husband and I, when I were married, tried to say, okay, how can we lower our carbon footprint this year? What concrete things can we do? And I think and I think you're right. You know, don't give money to companies that you know are racist or that you know have committed crimes or that you know there's a lot of them out there. And give your money to those that you think are doing the right way of being. I think that's a good idea.
Exactly, you know, and if we get that mindset and we start doing that, see, that is a critical mass. If we can get the people to start thinking wallet mind and where their money is going with their wallet minds, maybe we can turn this thing around, because that's what this country is all about. Capitalism is money, okay? Money, money, money.
Yeah.
Has no God, has no conscience, you know?
I hear you. When it comes, actually, when churches and money blended together on TV, then I knew we were in big trouble.
Yeah, you got that right.
Yeah, there was a book out called Stranger in a Strange Land, and it was out sometime in the end of the 60s. And in that, they had this, a televangelist and with almost like a variety show. And I thought it was so absurd, and it wasn't very many years then we were seeing it regularly on TV.
Yeah. Really?
Yep.
All right, mister. Look, it's great talking to you. Thank you much for the topic in the air.
Well, thank you for calling in. And I want to thank everybody else who's called in this morning. I appreciate it. We gave you a slow start to get going because I wanted to hear what Ryan Lenz of the Southern Poverty Law Center, let me say that right, had to say. And I wanted to make sure you guys had a chance to hear what he had to say, since he could only be with us for 20 minutes. I think the topic is important. It will continue. I don't know what's up for you next week when we have Ani and Lynn back, but I can only imagine that it will be something very good. And now I wanted to thank Derek Brooks. He's our AM News and Public Affairs Director. Crooks, I said, I can't speak this morning. I'm going to claim that I have a cold and I just can't speak. It is Derek Crooks. And right now we have Tammy as our engineer, and I want to thank her as well. So thank you all, and have a great day with KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8255.